To many people, the cross is a piece of jewelry or what's atop a church steeple. Most people don't see it as it really is, the centerpiece of history and the core of God's redemptive agenda. In recent days on Running to Win, we've been exploring God's view of the cross. But today, we'll focus on man's viewpoint. As we'll soon see, the contrast is startling. Stay with us. From Chicago's Moody Church, this is Running to Win with Dr. Erwin Lutzer, whose clear teaching helps us make it across the finish line. Today in his series on Why the Cross Can Do What Politics Can't, Dr. Lutzer brings message number 4, What Man Thinks of the Cross.
Whenever I'm on a plane, I like, if possible, to talk to the person next to me about Christ. This summer, my wife and I were riding together on a plane, and across the aisle from me, there was a woman who had a necklace with a cross. And ever wanting to be the person to build a bridge into people's lives and to try to find out where they might be spiritually, I said to her, "Thank you for wearing that cross." I said, "We really do have a great Savior, don't we?" And she looked at me and she said, "Well," she said, "I don't think that I maybe understand the cross like you do." She said, "Look at this." And she took the necklace, the pendants, and she put them in her hand, and she said, "Under the cross there is a Jewish star, and behind the Jewish star there is a little trinket to the Hindu god Om." She said, "I'm in social work, and I've discovered that people come to God in many different ways." Well, you can imagine the interesting discussion we had for the next 20 minutes as that plane was coming into a landing in Pittsburgh. As I had the opportunity to explain to her that you can put the cross on the same necklace as the god Om and other religions, but in reality, they can never be together. To think that the cross can be combined with other religions is to totally misunderstand it and to empty it of its power in your life. Can the cross be combined with other religions? Do we understand the cross if we think that that is possible? I want you to know today that the cross is a great divide. On the one hand, there are those who believe in it who have an eternal destiny with God forever. Those who understand it, not just those who pray a little prayer, but those who understand it. And on the other hand, there are those who despise it, though they think they honor it. After all, they may wear it as a necklace. But nevertheless, they despise its message, and they will spend eternity elsewhere, and never the twain shall meet, ever. The cross. What does man think of the cross? It is a scandal beyond irony that the very cross in which the Apostle Paul gloried and which means so much to God, as we learned last time, can mean so little to people, and that what God honors, men often despise. The passage I want you to turn to is 1 Corinthians chapter 1. 1 Corinthians chapter 1. City of Corinth, situated, of course, not too far from Athens. Some of us have been there. And the Apostle Paul wrote a letter to the fledgling church, which was once again one of those islands of righteousness in a sea of immorality. And he talks about the wisdom of this world. You'll notice 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 18, and he says, "For the word of the cross is to those who are perishing foolishness. But to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, 'I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the cleverness of the clever I will set aside.' Where is the wise man? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not come to know God, God was well pleased through the foolishness of the message preached to save those who believe. For indeed, Jews ask for a sign, and Greeks search for wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, to the Jews a stumbling block, and to the Gentiles foolishness, but to those who are called both Jews and Greeks, to them Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. Because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. Why does he bash human wisdom like he does? Well, there are two reasons. First of all, the problem rests in man's mind. It isn't that we're not smart. Just think of pocket calculators. Think of putting men on the moon, thinking of all of these technological discoveries, computers and the internet and viruses and all the other things that we have to put up with in life. Of course people are smart. The problem is that when they get beyond the physical and the mechanical and the scientific, and they begin to speculate in that realm which is sometimes called metaphysics, they do not have the building blocks upon which to construct the system to figure the world out. For example, if you had only the world, you would never conclude that God loved it. You could not possibly conclude that based on what is happening in Rwanda and other countries of the world, and where you see earthquakes and floods and devastations. You would never know how God was to be approached. You would know very little about him. And that's why you have today, as people cut themselves off from biblical revelation, you have pragmatism and relativism and individualism, because we are all like those ants that I've told you about on a Rembrandt painting, who notice the roughness of the canvas and the change of color beneath their feet, but they have no idea what the whole picture looks like. Men have a lot of knowledge. And when it comes to the things of this world, they have a lot of wisdom. But when they speculate about God, there is no way for them to possibly understand him. Problem is man's mind. The other problem, of course, is man's heart. We, at root, do not want to really understand God anyway. We are, at root, running from God because we are desire-driven. Take, for example, the issue that consumes a lot of our time, attention, and our prayer, the issue of abortion. As you know, all of the evidence, theological, physiological, philosophically, medically, is on our side in this debate, that pre-born infants are actually infants. And the amazing thing is, though, there are people who see this evidence and they still take a different position. And they still are in favor of the killing of preborn infants under certain circumstances. Now, why would that be when all the evidence is there? Because there is something within the human heart that says, I can discard the evidence when I want to do what I want to do and believe what I want to believe, because fundamentally there is an unwillingness to believe even despite the evidence. Remember that. We are all desire-driven. Much more so than we are willing to admit. Years ago, I remember reading a story of a man who was going to hire a secretary. So he asked his assistant to do a battery of tests on three secretaries, their typing skills, their aptitude, their experience. And after all of the tests were done, the assistant brought him all the information and said, here's all the information. The man says, just discard it. He says, I'm going to hire that beautiful brunette. In other words, it doesn't really matter what the evidence says. I want to do what I want to do. That's the nature of the human heart. And so the world by wisdom knows not God. The little that it knows about God, it discards, because at root we do not want to be subject to the Lord our God. Now, what I'd like to do in the next few moments is to show you scripturally, as we look at this passage, why it is that the wisdom of this world and the thoughts of this world clashes so pointedly with the message of the cross. And we pick up the text where I left reading, where the Apostle Paul says in verse 22, notice it says, indeed, the Jews ask for signs and the Greeks search for wisdom. And then you have to read verse 23 because they are connected together. But we preach Christ crucified, to the Jews, he is a stumbling block. And to the Greeks, he is foolishness. First of all, the cross runs counter and clashes with the pride of man, as represented by the Jews. The Jews sought for signs. The Jews were put off by the weakness of Jesus Christ. Far from being convinced that Jesus was the Messiah because he died on a cross, far from that convincing them, it did just the opposite. They said to themselves, who in the world would like to be aligned with somebody who's a loser? If the Messiah comes, surely he is going to be killing the Romans. The Romans are not going to be killing him. The scripture says that Jesus was crucified in weakness. I mean, there he hangs helplessly, and nobody is delivering him. Who can believe in a man like that, the Jews said? He's weak. Furthermore, they said, give us a sign. You know, they, of course, wanted a Messiah who is politically strong. They wanted a Messiah who would come and throw off the Roman occupation, and all those taxes, every denarius that was paid in anger and resentment to a foreign power. And they wanted political deliverance, and they wanted it right now. Furthermore, they said, give us a sign that we might believe thee. They kept pestering him, as recorded in the Gospels. What they wanted to do is to find somebody who could anything that they wanted and any miracle that they would suggest. Just like Pilate, as we learned last time. He said, give me a sign, do something. And Jesus kept silent. And this reticence of Christ, this hesitancy, really bothered the Jews. And they said, if he's the Messiah, why doesn't he do those big miracles that we think he should? Years later, there was someone who came along who said that he would be able to part the Jordan River by his word. And he gathered a whole group of disciples at the Jordan River and commanded it to stop flowing. As you've guessed, it continued to flow. And then there was another man who took 30,000 people to the top of the Mount of Olives and said, when you are here at my command, the walls of Jerusalem are going to collapse. Well, the walls didn't collapse. That's the kind of a sign the Jews were looking for. Give us something big. Jesus says, there shall no sign be given to you except the sign of the prophet Jonah, because as he was 3 days in the heart of the fish, so shall the Son of Man be in the heart of the earth. Jesus said, the resurrection is my final, most complete, the best verified sign you're ever going to get. Throughout the history of the church, this has been a question. How many signs do we need in order to believe? There's been even a whole movement called Signs and Wonders. This was a problem for the reformers. Because when they began to look at the Bible and they began to peel away layers of tradition to get to the message of the cross, Rome said, but you don't have miracles and we do. We have statues that weep and we have relics that multiply themselves and you have nothing. The reformers said, to us, the power is in the message itself. This is Pastor Lutzer, my friend. And yes, I hope that you are convinced that there is power in the message itself. Maybe you feel that you're not very good at sharing that message of the cross, but invite people to read the New Testament. Read it with them. Help them to see that indeed our message is all wrapped up in Jesus who died for us as sinners.
Thank you, Dr. Lutzer. On today's Running to Win, Dr. Erwin Lutzer brought part one of What Man Thinks of the Cross, another message in his series on why the cross can do what politics can't. On Monday, this message will continue. Running to Win comes to you from the Moody Church in Chicago. When it comes to faith and politics, we all need clear teaching. This 8-part CD series can be yours as our thank you when you give a gift of any amount to support Running to Win. Just call us at 1-800-215-5001. That's 1-800-215-5001. Online, go to offerrtw.com. That's offerrtw, all one word, .com. Or write to Running to Win at Box 11174, Chicago, Illinois, 60611. This is Dave McAllister. Join us Monday for our next Running to Win.